Hey Dreamers, this is Jen from Ottawa, Ontario, Canada. I'm just sitting here watching hockey and eating my poutine, and I just want to say a huge thanks to everybody in the Katie group for making it such a special place to go and be a part of every day. Roseanne is an amazing host, eh? Anywho, on with the second part of the series. You are listening to California Dreaming on the Orbital Jigsaw Network.
Hello Dreamers. This episode is the second part of a two-part series. If you have not listened to part one of the bonus of the Stopwatch Gang, pause this here, listen to part one first, then come back to this. Thank you for your patience in waiting for me to get this vacation series episode finished. So, without further ado, please enjoy this second part of this very special bonus vacation series episode of California Dreaming that's taken us to the province of Ontario, Canada. The tale of the Stopwatch Gang. The day was September 23rd, 1980. Their target, the Bank of America, located on Garnet Avenue in San Diego. Patty was in the rental car outside the bank, near our side entrance. Stephen and Lionel were getting ready to enter the bank. This particular job would have them do what they could to casually mingle amongst the customers while they waited for the precise time that they've spent weeks researching when the armored truck would arrive and pick up the money bags. Remember, their theory was that they needed to have some outlandish disguises in order to have certain unusual aspects of their outfits to stand out to various witnesses that would certainly be questioned extensively by the FBI once all was said and done. So the outfit Stephen chose was a bright blue three-piece suit. He donned a fake beard, oversized glasses, and a big black wig that pretty much looked like an afro. Lionel chose a gray suit with a tie, a thick, moppy-looking blonde wig, and a fake blonde goatee. Stephen thought he kinda looked like Colonel Sanders. They also put on a thick layer of dark tan foundation in order to alter their complexion, and they covered their fingertips with clear tape so they would not be leaving any fingerprints anywhere. In all of this, their outfits and everything would be captured on bank surveillance cameras. Stephen and Lionel each entered the bank, one right after another, about a minute apart or so. They went over to the places in the bank that they predetermined they would each be while they waited for the armored truck to show up. Lionel stood at the counter where customers filled out their bank deposit slips. Stephen, who was carrying a briefcase, sat over on some cushioned chairs where customers signed in for appointments to speak with bankers about financial matters. In his briefcase, Stephen had an Uzi. After about 5 minutes passed, Stephen, shifting around uncomfortably in his seat, began to become concerned about the armored truck. It hadn't shown up yet, and he didn't understand. He had spent an entire month watching the Loomis truck pull up to the bank at just about the same time, week in and week out, like clockwork. So where was the truck? Soon, 10 minutes passed. Still no armored truck. Lionel continued to stand at the counter, scribbling on a deposit slip, crumpling it up, tossing it in the trash, and repeat. Whether it was warm outside or warm in the bank or warm in those three-piece suits or if it was just their nerves, beads of sweat began forming on both Stephen and Lionel's foreheads. Lionel, filling out his umpteenth deposit slip, wiped some sweat away from his forehead. When he looked down at his hand, some of his tan foundation had smeared on the back of his hand. This was not going well. In his seat, Stephen was dripping sweat too. So much so, the tape covering his fingertips started to peel. Patty was sweating it out too, waiting in the getaway car. Once 15 minutes had passed, Lionel was getting anxious. He glanced over at Stephen, looking for a nod or a cue to call it quits. But Stephen continued to sit, determined to wait it out. Finally, after nearly a half hour, The Loomis truck appeared near the entrance of the bank. As usual, the driver of the truck stayed inside while the second guard got out and came into the bank. He was a guard who had been on the job for 9 years, Harlan Lee Hudson. A fairly large and burly man, he had on sunglasses, which he kept on even while he was inside the bank. He knew all the tellers, always taking the time to make a little small talk every week when he got there. Stephen watched intently as Harlan began making his trips from the vault to the waiting truck outside. The bags on the first cart he rolled out were obviously filled with coins, as were the bags on the second trip. Stephen signaled to Lionel to hang tight. They weren't trying to rob the bank of a bunch of coins. It was the guard's third trip out of the vault that had the bags full of paper money. As Harlan was about halfway across the lobby, as he just passed the chair that Stephen had been anxiously sitting in for more than 30 minutes by then, Stephen stood up and shoved the barrel of his gun into the guard's side. "Don't be a hero. This is a robbery." Harlan would later describe the robber as cool, calm, collected, and cordial. Lionel approached the guard from behind and removed the weapon from his holster. This time, he didn't tuck it into his waistband. Stephen ordered everyone else inside the bank to get down onto the ground while he and Lionel grabbed a total of 4 bags of cash, each of them stuffed as full as possible with bills. So much so, the rectangular shape of the bricks of cash could clearly be seen through the canvas bags. From there, they casually exited the bank. Meanwhile, one of the bank tellers had activated a silent alarm, and when that happened, surveillance cameras were also activated, which began taking photos of the inside of the bank from every angle at 5-second intervals. And with that, the stopwatch gang had successfully pulled off the largest bank robbery in San Diego history, having walked out of the Bank of America with a total of $283,000. All of it in broad daylight, in full view of witnesses and cameras. After waiting nearly a half hour for the guards to show up, from the time they pulled their gun on the guard to the time they made their way out the front door, the whole thing took all of 90 seconds. They got into the getaway car waiting outside with Patty at the wheel, and they drove off. Then they went into their typical, well-planned-out getaway phase. They began by removing all of their gaudy disguises and stuffing all of that into trash bags. The cash was taken out of the bank bags and transferred into duffel bags along with their weapons, taking the money wraps off the cash as they go and throwing those into the trash bags along with their suits, ties, wigs, beards, and the bank bags. They headed over to one of the apartments that they had rented that had the underground parking, where their second getaway car was parked. They next peeled the bright racing stripe they had added to their rental car and tossed all that into the garbage bag too. They put a new set of stolen plates on the rental car, and while Lionel drove off with all of the evidence from the robbery in the second getaway car, Stephen took the money and the guns back up to their apartment. And as for Patty, he took off jogging. As I said before, back into the bank to check out everything that's been going on at the crime scene, which was a thing he really enjoyed doing. Everything seemed as though it had gotten off without a hitch, right? Well, not so fast. The first threat to their plan was the late arrival of the armored truck. Well, as it were, that day, whatever was going on in and around the busy streets of San Diego, another truck was taking too long as well. The garbage truck. After the robbery, Patty and Stephen made their way back to Sedona, Arizona. Lionel, he stayed back to get rid of all of the evidence including the very incriminating bag full of their disguises, money wrappers, bank bags, etc. The plan was for Lionel to burn the evidence, but he chose to put it in a garbage dumpster instead. And he usually waited nearby the dumpster to make sure it would be emptied by the garbage truck, so he could be certain the stuff would be long gone. He knew when the pickup times were. They'd used this dumpster before. But as he was waiting, a San Diego patrol car with two officers inside pulled up and parked to have lunch. Lionel got nervous and left before the bags of evidence were picked up. And what do you know? A little while later on that afternoon, an older couple collecting bottles and cans for recycling peered into the dumpster and saw a trash bag with a little bit of one of the wigs poking out of it. Now, I would have been totally freaked out, thinking for sure that there were body parts in that bag. But I don't know what the elderly couple thought, or if they were just super focused on collecting recyclables and just looked in the bag, just in case there was something good. But when they opened it, they discovered the bag contained numerous wigs, beards, two license plates, an empty pack of Winston cigarettes, a bottle of CoverGirl Foundation, Bank of America money bags, and paper money wrappers. The garbage truck had failed to show up on time as well. Police were contacted and alerted to the items found inside the dumpster. Among all the things that I listed that were found inside the trash bags, investigators also discovered the airport car rental paperwork, and along with that, a photocopy of a fake Arizona driver's license belonging to the person who rented the vehicle. Even though the name was fake, the picture was real, and it was clear. A balding, thin man with big ears. They were also able to lift one partial thumbprint off one of the Bank of America bags. The stopwatch gang had no idea that the investigation, though moving at a slow pace at first, would soon be gaining some momentum for the FBI. Meanwhile, back in Arizona, the gang began discussing their future. They had gotten away with more money than they ever had in the past, and the one thing that they did agree on was that they wanted to get out of the bank robbery business. They ruminated about getting some cosmetic surgery done so they can remove anything distinguishing, like moles or scars. They did know that they would have to figure out another way to earn money if they weren't going to be doing bank robberies anymore. They talked about drug smuggling, maybe something simple like marijuana. Stephen, while living in Arizona, he took lessons and became licensed to pilot a plane. With some of his proceeds from the robbery, he bought himself a silver Mooney 201 plane. They began doing some research, looking for places in Central America where they could pick up shipments of marijuana and fly low off the radar and slip across the American border. It sounded a lot easier than robbing banks, and they knew that that line of so-called work would only get more and more difficult as banks worked on ways to make it more challenging to rob them. Well, some time had passed, several weeks after the robbery. The guys were kicking back in Sedona, not in too big of a rush when it came to figuring out what to do next, when Stephen heard that an old friend was looking for him. A guy he knew from back in Ottawa, Ontario. A guy named Donnie Hollingsworth, though he went by the nickname Big John. He was a guy who enjoyed quite a successful run on the Canadian Football League's the Ottawa Rough Riders as a halfback. He was just as successful, if not more so, as a criminal, and he was pretty well known. He was often envied by the up-and-coming local criminals, especially since he drove a Rolls Royce around town. And Stephen had been one of those that looked up to the guy. Patty, however, he wasn't too keen on him. There was something about him that he just didn't trust. But they still had conducted business with him in the past. Big John was the one who helped them fence the gold that they got from the Ottawa airport job. And over the years, Stephen had kept in touch with him. They all eventually ended up in California, and it was Big John who helped the guys get their hands on some guns and Kevlar vests as they were getting ready to do all those robberies up and down California. Big John now needed a favor. He had been part of a crystal meth ring that was being operated in a remote cabin about an hour and a half outside of San Diego. The place had been the target of a police raid when a customer of theirs died while testing out the latest batch that they had cooked up. Big John had loaded the dead guy into his car and dumped the body on a remote roadside. Well, someone saw him dumping the body, took note of the car's license plate, and reported it to police. They showed up at the cabin, and despite an attempt to flee by jumping through a plate glass window, Big John was caught and taken to jail. He was looking for Stephen for help with the bail, $80,000, with a promise to pay it back within 2 months plus interest. Stephen didn't hesitate to help out an old friend. Besides, he might need the same favor in return someday. And the Stopwatch Gang continued to stay settled and relaxed at their Sedona, Arizona home. Stephen enjoyed flying his plane across the picturesque landscape of Arizona, across the canyons and the mesas. And when he was done, he would go to his new favorite place for appetizers and margaritas at a place he found close to the airport. And that was where, one late afternoon, about a month after the robbery, when he saw three men walking into the restaurant. They had on trench coats and looked very much like law enforcement to Stephen, though he couldn't be sure. You'd think if cops were going around looking for them, they'd try to be a little less conspicuous. Well, nothing ended up happening. They probably weren't cops. I mean, that'd be too obvious, right? Stephen decided his paranoia was getting the best of him, and he just put the whole incident out of his mind. Well, as it turned out, Stephen wasn't wrong. Those guys were, in fact, with the FBI. They were in Sedona, Arizona to look for the Stopwatch Gang, but their warrants weren't quite ready yet. They were in the works when Stephen had seen them at the restaurant. They were just waiting. The agent assigned to the Stopwatch Gang was Stephen Chenoweth, agent in charge at the FBI's Flagstaff, Arizona office. The majority of his assignments were violent bank robberies, and he had no shortage of work. At the time, Arizona was clocking an average of 250 or more bank robberies annually. Agent Chenoweth knew that he had to tread carefully when it came to the Stopwatch Gang. Every report that he received always included this warning: armed, dangerous, and escape risks. By mid-October, they had already found the home that they had rented in Oak Creek Canyon. And the way the area was laid out, there was only one way in and one way out. Everything else surrounding the area was steep and rough terrain. You pretty much could not approach their home without being noticed. The agent also knew, based on his investigation, that the gang, particularly Stephen, they were actually really well-liked by the neighbors and the community. So the fear was that word could easily get back to them if someone figured out that the FBI were snooping around town looking for them. So when they got to town, they only let one sheriff know that they were there, which turned out to be a pretty good idea because they would later discover Stephen had become very close friends with another local deputy. And another problem the FBI was having was they could not confirm that the guys that they were tracking were actually the three men wanted for the long history of crimes that they had been involved in, convicted of, and on the run from. All three of them were still very much wanted fugitives back in Canada. But finally, an anonymous informant confirmed the identities of the three men. They were indeed Stephen Reed, Patty Mitchell, and Lionel Wright. Once they had that information confirmed, they were able to get in touch with Canadian authorities to get their files, which included their mugshots and their fingerprints. They were able to finally match up that partial thumbprint found on the Bank of America money bag, confirming their involvement with the heist. Their arrest warrants were issued on October 30th, 1980, on charges of bank robbery and conspiracy. The next day, on Halloween, Stephen was pulled over in a traffic stop as he was headed to the airport and taken into custody. Lionel was arrested back at the Oak Creek Canyon house. Agents kicked in the door, and a very stunned and a very naked Lionel Wright was still in bed. Stephen fessed up right away to who he was, but Lionel, he kept his mouth shut. And it would remain that way pretty much forever. Lionel Wright would never speak not one single word to law enforcement regarding who he was and what he was accused of, ever. Stephen and Lionel would be extradited back to California and held in lieu of $1.5 million in bail. The steep bail was due to the fact that they had this history of escaping, so they're kind of screwed now. And by the next day, the news splashed on the front pages of the newspapers across Canada that Stephen and Lionel were in custody. But Patty, he was still on the run. Where he was, authorities had no idea. Stephen and Lionel ultimately decided not to fight the charges. In April of 1981, they both pleaded guilty and were sentenced to 20 years in federal prison for the San Diego Bank of America heist. Since they didn't go to trial, it was never revealed who it was that gave the FBI the information about their identities, leading to them being able to obtain their rap sheets from Canada. And part of the guilty plea included the guys turning over what they could of the stolen money that was left. But for whatever reason, that part of the deal fell through. And when that happened, it was then that they learned who it was that ratted them out. None other than Stephen's friend, the guy that he had helped bail out of jail, Donnie Big John Hollingsworth. Yeah, he totally betrayed Stephen's friendship and trust. After Big John had gotten himself in that hot water involving the meth lab and dumping that body of that dead guy, he didn't even think twice about throwing his friend under the bus in order to score himself a sweetheart deal. As a matter of fact, for the information he would be willing to provide for authorities, he would not only get his charges reduced, but his bail reduced as well. And that bail, ironically, Stephen would be the one to put up for his friend. And not only did he give up the names of Stephen, Lionel, and Patty to authorities, he also embellished the story as well, telling the FBI through his attorney that these guys were true professionals and they would have not a problem killing anyone who got in their way. They wore Kevlar vests and they were always armed with automatic weapons. I mean, yes, these guys were bank robbers, and they do so armed with weapons. But never had they so much caused anyone any type of physical injury. They never shot anyone. They never killed anyone. And based on what I've told you about these guys, they really aren't the types. Regardless, he gave up his friends and told authorities who they were and where they were. And Stephen, he was very upset at the betrayal. And he would go on to point out to the court in regards to the case against him that the first person he contacted when he was arrested was Big John. You know, he needed that favor for the bail returned. Big John was the one who hired Stephen's lawyer for him. the same guy whose confidential testimony helped prosecute the very same case. And not only that, Big John was the one who was supposed to be the intermediary in charge of returning the money stolen from the bank robbery. Money which, by the way, ended up going missing, causing the negotiations for their plea deal to crumble. So this guy, Big John, he was making deals on both sides, getting a sweetheart deal for himself and lining his own pockets with the stolen money he was commissioned to return on behalf of Stephen, Lionel, and Patty, and all the while pretending he was helping them, at the same time helping the FBI. Now, that guy is a bona fide louse. I mean, everybody in this story is crooked, but this guy, he's a special kind of crooked to be stabbing his friends in the back and ratting them all out. Stephen and Lionel, they were given new court-appointed attorneys, and they were able to negotiate a new deal, and their sentences were almost cut in half. What happened with Big John Hollingsworth was really an embarrassment for the FBI. But even though he had managed to get himself out of trouble with his arrest related to the death of that guy at his meth lab, he found himself in a whole different set of problems once that stolen money had been re-stolen, ostensibly by Big John himself. So, in turn, Stephen and Lionel were compelled to provide testimony before a grand jury as to what they knew regarding Big John's other criminal exploits. And you would think these two guys would jump at the chance to trade their testimony for some more time shaved off their sentences. But they didn't. Lionel, as I said earlier, would never speak to authorities or anyone about anything ever, end of story. And Stephen, ratting on people was not a thing he was willing to do. Both men were held in contempt of court, and the judge added another 11 months onto their sentences. Even though he was really angry with Big John to the point his feelings for the guy boiled over into a very strong hatred for him, there was just this code that Stephen lived by, and that meant more to him than anything else. Stephen and Lionel chose to just take their sentences and quietly serve their time. They didn't even appeal. The plan was just to wait it out and eventually be sent back to Canada. At that point, they would begin working on plans to escape again. While in prison in the United States, the Department of Corrections knew better than to keep Stephen and Lionel in the same prison. So Lionel was sent to serve his time at Leavenworth, which is a medium security federal prison located in northeastern Kansas. As for Stephen, his time was going to be served a little bit different. For almost a year after his sentencing, Stephen was essentially carted around the country by bus, going from jail to jail every few days. He spent a couple of nights in the county lockup in one state, and then they'd move him to another county lockup in the next state over, and so on. Authorities did this in order to keep it difficult for anyone to track him, so nobody would be able to find him or help him plan yet another prison break. And I'm pretty sure Mr. Stephen Reed isn't going to be given any day passes or lunch outings while in custody of the United States Federal Bureau of Prisons. Eventually, Stephen made his last stop at the United States Penitentiary in Marion, Illinois. This was a place where inmates from Alcatraz were sent once it was closed. This is a prison where foreign and domestic terrorists are housed, mob guys, among others, and one of the others included former Major League Baseball player and Cincinnati Reds manager Pete Rose, who served 5 months at the penitentiary in Marion on a tax evasion conviction. This is not a place for prisoners to be rehabilitated. They are mostly kept in solitary confinement, and they aren't given work or any jobs to do while incarcerated. So Stephen was pretty sure escaping from Marion would be impossible. So he stayed focused on trying to get transferred back to Canada. He began a letter-writing campaign. He implored the Canadian consulate, He contacted everyone that he could think of that might be able to help further his cause. After about 2 years, Canada was like, okay, you can come back to Millhaven Institute back in Ontario. Oh, and because Canada is so nice to their inmates, Stephen got to be back with his old buddy Lionel Wright, who had also just been granted a transfer back to Millhaven. But Stephen, he decided to make the best of his time there. Might as well, eh? He quickly built up his reputation again as a really popular guy, and again, a favorite of the staff and corrections officers as well. He was put in charge of that good old Canadian prison sports program where he organized the hockey teams and the baseball team. Yeah, baseball too. He also had his hand in the illegal stuff too. Gambling, selling hashish, and get this. Whenever inmates and guards had a problem, he was the unofficial mediator to help settle the disputes. If Canadian prisons had mayors, Stephen would be it at Millhaven. But despite this, Stephen and Lionel still wanted to get out of there. I mean, even though this time in Canadian prisons seems like a cakewalk, the prison itself was still a pretty bad place. It had a reputation for being exceptionally violent. It was like that when they were housed there back in 1977. And by this time, when they were back again, it was 1984 and things had only grown worse. Eventually, after a slew of violent stabbings, including the killing of Stephen's hockey team's goalie, Stephen just couldn't take it anymore. For all his shortcomings and his criminal behaviors, Stephen generally cared about people, especially his friends, and he had this sensitive side to him. Once his goalie was murdered, that shattered him. He didn't feel like continuing on with all of the things that he was involved in prison. The sports teams, all the hustling, he backed off everything and retreated into a state of depression, sadness, and anger. He would spend most of his days from then on writing. In the beginning, his writings were mostly just the venting of his feelings. None of it made any real sense. But soon he had before him the makings of a novel, pretty much based on he and his two friends as bank robbers. In the next cell over, Lionel would take Stephen's writings and type everything out for him. The main character of his story was named Bobby, a person loosely based on Stephen himself. His buddy was Denny, his fictional version of Lionel. But the story ended with Bobby killing Denny. And when he finally passed along the final pages of his novel, he could hear Lionel plucking away at his typewriter, and soon it had come to a stop. Lionel, he was saddened and disappointed at the way the story ended so violently. But it was done. Stephen had a final version of his manuscript. Well, it just so happened about the time that Stephen had finished his manuscript, he was contacted by Fred Desrochers, a professor of criminology at Ontario's University of Waterloo. He was writing a book about infamous Canadian bank robbers and wanted to interview Stephen. At first, Stephen was like, nah, he didn't want to talk to the professor. But then he reconsidered with the condition. Would Professor Desrochers be willing to read his manuscript? Sure, he'd read it if that meant he can get his interview. And when he finally did read it, he was impressed. He passed it on to another professor at Waterloo, writer and novelist Susan Musgrave, and she fell in love with the story. She began feverishly writing to Stephen. She was excited about the prospect of publishing his works. She began by writing an excerpt of his writings in a quarterly literary publication. Stephen was beside himself, just thrilled that he was finally about something more than just being a criminal. His first reply to Susan came in the way of 13 separate letters and one poem. It read, "Roses are red, violets are dead. As will be you, if you don't visit soon. P.S. Bring lots of drugs." Susan, as it turned out, was in the midst of a very tumultuous relationship. Her husband, of all things, was a drug smuggler. She sure can pick him, right? He had gone to jail, so the marriage went south. So once that happened and she connected with Stephen, she began visiting him in jail, and she would help him fine-tune his manuscript into a publishable body of work. Her publisher quickly bought it, and not only that, commissioned Stephen to write two more. And Susan and Stephen fell for one another. She wasn't going to be in Ontario for very much longer. Her position at the University of Waterloo finalized, so she was going to be going back to her home on Vancouver Island. She began her own letter-writing campaign, lobbying the director of prisons to approve a transfer for Stephen to a prison closer to her in British Columbia. Then something totally out of character for anyone involved in the Canadian justice system happened when the regional prison director criticized Susan, someone he described as an intelligent, accomplished woman. Why was she wasting her time on a person like Stephen? First off, I don't know what business it was of the prison director to be saying anything of the sort to Susan like that. And secondly, that's kind of rich coming from a guy who works for the very system that granted Stephen not one, but 2 day passes where on both occasions, while having lunch, he managed to escape from his day pass escort. It's like, who are you to criticize? You're the ones who were trying to train Stephen to become a hairstylist when he integrated back into society. But now he's finally met a nice woman who loves him, who probably sees a bright and promising future for him as an author. And oh, she's wasting her time. The whole thing kind of annoyed me. But anyway, Stephen got his transfer, but not before the director of prison stuck his nose in Stephen's business again by urging him to not squander this chance to start over. Yeah, okay, dude, thanks for the advice. Stephen was transferred to the Kent Institution, which is located in Agassiz, British Columbia. Susan came by to see him each week so they can work on refining his novel, as well as their budding relationship. Stephen eventually came up for his first bid at parole, but he was denied. So Susan had an idea. Because Canada had been implementing and increasing the availability for the extended 3-day family visit, aka conjugal visits, she suggested that they get married. That way, they would be eligible to apply for the private family visit. And once again, the Canadian justice system strikes again. I'm kidding. The United States has conjugal visits too, but actually only in 4 states. California, Washington, New York, and Connecticut. So the majority of the states in the United States do not allow for them. And the states that do are super stingy with it, and there are strict rules and eligibility guidelines. But as for Canada, part of the system of rehabilitation also involves the preservation of family relations. So yeah, I'm not necessarily opposed to that. It's just, even though it is a thing here in California, it's just not something that is easy to have granted. So anyway, in 1986, Stephen published his book entitled Jackrabbit Parole. After that, Stephen and Susan became somewhat of a celebrity couple up in Canada, and the CBC would even broadcast their wedding when they got married in prison. Stephen ended up being transferred once more to a place closer to Susan's, and by May of 1987, he was granted parole. Lionel, however, would end up remaining in prison until 1994. He just did not have the desire or the will to work the system the way Stephen did. After he was denied parole once, he didn't try again after that. To Stephen, and he kind of understood, it was just the way that Lionel was. He never wanted to talk about his crimes. Going up for parole meant he'd have to do that. Talk about what he did. Own it. Show remorse, and he'd rather not. Stephen would see Lionel once more in Kingston just after his 1994 release. After that, on occasion, Lionel would send Stephen a card. But before long, Stephen noticed the cards and letters would stop. As for Patty Mitchell, he was still a fugitive. He was never picked up for the San Diego bank robbery after Stephen and Lionel were arrested back in Sedona, Arizona. When they were taken into custody, Patty just so happened to be out of town at the time. He was with his girlfriend's parents, who lived in Iowa. When he found out Stephen and Lionel had been arrested, he surreptitiously came back to Arizona and took about $300,000 that they had kept in a safe deposit box, and he was gone. And from there, he began a solo criminal career. Remember, he was the one who had the toughest time with the armed robberies and all that. But something in him turned. Without them, he had to step it up if he was going to make it alone. He went back to Florida and began robbing department stores again. From there, he made his way west across the United States. He hit a bank in Hot Springs, Arkansas. But Arizona be damned, he was arrested in Phoenix when he flubbed the department store robbery. When Patty was brought before a judge to have his bail set, the judge actually didn't know he was looking at FBI's most wanted fugitive number 432, Patrick Michael Mitchell, because he was using the alias Richard Landry. So his bail was set at $16,500, at which point Patty got in touch with his friend back in Dundee, Florida, the one who gave him the job and the place to stay at that Shamrock Motel. He flew from Florida to Phoenix and gave the bail bondsman $20,000 in cash. Patty was free once again, and of course he would not be showing up for his next court date. He would, however, be showing up for some more robbing. It took about a year, but the FBI finally caught up with Patty in Florida again. He was extradited to California, and all kinds of books were thrown at him from that point forward. 10 years for the San Diego robbery, 20 years for the Hot Springs robbery, 19 years for the Phoenix robbery, plus he still owed Canada 20 years for the airport gold robbery. Oh, and the United States wasn't about to send Patty to serve some easy time in federal prison. Nope, he was going to the maximum security state penitentiary located in Florence, Arizona. And there, he would not have much of a chance of winning himself a transfer back to Canada either. And as for his chances for an escape, that's a big fat no way. Nobody had ever successfully pulled off an escape from Florence. And anyone who did try ended up shot and killed by watchtower guards. But dreamers, you know what Patty Mitchell would say to that? Hold my beer? Well, but since he's in prison, he probably doesn't have beer. So maybe hold my hooch? Perhaps. These walls would not hold Patty in forever. He spent his time trying to be a model prisoner. The warden had even said at one time Patty was the nicest criminal he'd ever met. And with that, he was given some of the jobs around the prison, one of those being working as a janitor. He was assigned to the visitor room, which is located in the administration building. And all the while, he was planning one of the most daring escapes in the history of the Arizona state prison system. This particular area of the prison was air-conditioned. Of course, it gets really hot in Arizona. And from there, Patty would have access to the duct system in the ceiling. And 4 years into his sentence, he would do just that. He crawled into the duct system right across the top of the warden's office and made his way out to a utility shed that was not secured behind the prison fences. He casually strolled across the parking lot to a getaway car that was waiting for him. And once again, he was gone. From there, Patty became Gary Weber, insurance investigator. And instead of just leaving Arizona and heading to another state, he decided to leave the country and the continent altogether. He headed to the Philippines. He got married and together they had a son named Richard. The family settled in a mountainous area, and for the next 5 years, from time to time, Patty would travel back to the United States, rob some banks to support his family, then go back to the Philippines. But in 1993, a little show called America's Most Wanted featured Patty on a segment, at which point a couple who had been vacationing in the Philippines happened to meet Patty at one of the local establishments. And he had been quite friendly to them. Well, they recognized him and phoned in a tip that he was in the Philippines. But by the time the FBI was able to make their way to Patty's house, he had packed up and left. He caught wind that they were onto him. Patty headed back to the United States. He had to get back to robbing banks. And his next bank robbery, it would be his curtain call as a bank robber and a free man. He ended up in South Haven, Mississippi. He had this genius idea. At least he thought it was genius. In order to create a diversion, he phoned in a bomb threat. He figured the local police would gather together and take care of that. Then, with all the cops busy on one side of town, he would pull off a bank robbery on the other side of town. But law enforcement, they didn't fall for it. As a matter of fact, their first inclination was that it was a diversionary tactic in order to distract them so a bank robbery could be attempted. So instead of going on a wild goose chase for a phantom bomb threat, they ramped up their surveillance of all the town's banks. And just a short time later, Patty was seen running out of one of South Haven's banks wearing some really tacky neon tassels attached to his sunglasses, along with $160,000 he had just stolen from the bank. He was promptly arrested. And with that, Patty Mitchell's life of crime and life on the run was over for good. He was sentenced to 65 years in prison, and he would be sent to the federal penitentiary at Leavenworth in Kansas. And his chances of ever leaving there, even earning a transfer back to Canada, were just about zero. Stephen was 36 years old when he was paroled from prison in 1987. Yeah, only 36. You would think with all that he'd been through up to that point, he'd be like in his 60s, right? No, he was only 36. Lots of life yet to live. He lived with his wife, Susan. She had a cottage in Sydney on Vancouver Island in British Columbia, but they called it the treehouse. It happened to have a huge Douglas fir that grew straight up through the middle of the kitchen. She had one daughter from a previous marriage, Charlotte, and then in 1989, Stephen and Susan had another daughter together. For the next decade, Stephen lived a quiet, idyllic life. His novel became a bestseller, and the couple enjoyed their notoriety for their love story and their success as authors. Stephen continued writing, penning two plays. He was an instructor at a nearby community college. He was even given the role of an armored car guard in the 1999 French-Canadian movie entitled 4 Days. Stephen was appointed to the Royal Commission of the Citizens Forum on National Unity. the Canadian correction system enlisted him to teach creative writing, as well as be a counselor working with prisoners who needed guidance in getting back their normal, free lives. Together, Stephen and Susan ran in circles with Canada's most esteemed writers, academics, and luminaries. And Stephen truly embraced his role as a national symbol of Canada's rehabilitation program, as he had truly become a reformed criminal. But as time wore on, Stephen began to feel as though the public really didn't see him as a great writer and scholar with an incredible body of work. He began to feel that people were really only enamored with the legend of Stephen Reed, the bandit and the criminal. The truth was, he really didn't fit in the social circles his wife so seamlessly was a part of. And the reality of that really hit him when he and Susan had attended a party with a bunch of old writers and academics. It was very elegant. And as the night wore on, the groups discussed literature, art, politics, topics that Stephen really didn't have knowledge of or anything to contribute. Eventually, the host of the party addressed Stephen and said, "Regale us with stories of prison life." He was mortified, like he was some sort of court jester there to amuse these elitists. But he was put on the spot. So he did. He just talked up as much as he could about some of his experiences in prison. The feeling he had in that moment stayed with him for years to come. He would never be able to publish a follow-up to his bestseller. And by the time the turn of the millennium was approaching, he had finally reached his 49th birthday, and he was more depressed than ever. Then one day he was sitting outside a local cafe when he happened to encounter an old friend. He had just attended another luncheon where he felt like an outsider trying to fit in. His old friend saw that Stephen was down and asked him if he wanted to come over to his place and hang out. But they weren't really going to hang out. He could see his friend was high, and he looked like he got high a lot on heroin. Stephen knew, but he went anyway. And soon, Stephen was high on heroin as well. As he made his way home, he became sick and had to pull over to throw up. Then when he came into the house, Susan could tell right away that he was on something. She ran into the bathroom and cried. Remember, it was his birthday. She had been waiting there for him. There was a cake in the kitchen and a whole bunch of presents that she had for him. But it was too late. Stephen was hooked. A couple days later, he went back to his friend's house and he kept going back. He started off smoking, then snorting, then injecting. Eventually, Stephen began shooting up speedballs, heroin mixed with cocaine. Because of his old connections from his previous life, he was able to get his hands on the purest cocaine and the highest quality heroin. He began supplying drugs for his new group of junkie friends he was now finding himself with every single day. And soon, he was in debt to his dealers to the tune of about $90,000. He was too proud to ask for more time to pay them, so instead, he decided to go back to what he knew best, bank robbery. On the morning of June 9th, 1999, Stephen shot up a speedball as he sat on a toilet in a gas station bathroom. He came back out, got into a stolen car which was being driven by a guy named Alan McCollum. He was a junkie too, and he was an amateur, but he would have to do. They headed over to a strip mall in Victoria, where at one end of the shops, there was a Royal Bank of Canada branch. Stephen chose this because it was very close to a neighborhood and then some woods and hills, and it seemed like an easy getaway. But the prep work for this job was a far cry from the professionalism, if you can call it that, of his previous heists. This one, it was very hastily put together. The gloves he wore barely fit. He tried to fashion a uniform out of a dark blue varsity jacket. On it, he spelled out the words police in yellow tape, the letters all crooked. Also, on a baseball cap, the same taped letters he used to spell out the word SWAT. But the one thing he legitimately was this time was Stephen was heavily armed. He had a duffel bag. In it, he had a 12-gauge pump-action shotgun, a long-barrel 22-caliber pistol, and in his waistband, he had a 44 Magnum. And in the back seat was the gun that he was going to use in the event they were involved in a police chase. An AK-47 with a clip filled with steel-jacketed rounds. Alan pulled up behind the bank and parked. Stephen put on a mask. It was see-through, but it had red-painted cheeks and red lips. He entered into the bank and demanded that everyone get onto the floor. Somebody open the safe and bring him the deposit bags, then unlock the rear door. One woman on the ground raised up her head and spoke. The safes cannot be opened for another hour, and the deposit bags have already been picked up. The key to the back door is in the office, top drawer, on the right. She also told him the only money they had was in one teller drawer, and when he opened it, all that was in there were some fives and tens. It wasn't enough, and Stephen was desperate. He glanced around the bank and soon noticed the door that led to the room behind the ATM machine. The bank manager unlocked the door and Stephen emptied the contents of the ATM into his bag. He left out the back door with $93,000. But the bank robbery, it had taken way too much time. After he had tossed the bag into the trunk, he noticed a cop on the sidewalk. She was on foot patrol, and she had her gun pointed right at him. Just as he jumped in the car, he yelled at Alan to go. They peeled out of the parking lot, almost taking out a horse-drawn carriage carrying a group of tourists. Alan slammed on the brakes, avoiding hitting them. Their car hopped a curb and landed on a bike path and went straight into some metal posts. Stephen had slammed his head into the dashboard when the crash happened, and when he looked over at Alan, it did not look like he was willing to continue driving. Stephen wasn't going to give up just yet. He maneuvered his left leg to the driver's side and pressed the accelerator. He could see at least one cop car and one motorcycle cop descending upon them. Their car scraped past the metal post and kept going up the bike path. The cop car held back, but the motorcycle cop was still coming. At this point, Stephen didn't care about anything other than getting away. Running out of options, he decided to do the one thing that he had never done before in any of his previous heists. He was going to open fire on the motorcycle cop. He grabbed his shotgun, leaned out the window, and fired, but made sure to aim high. He fell back into the car because of the kickback of the shotgun. They continued driving through a neighborhood called James Bay. The motorcycle cop was momentarily slowed down by the shotgun blast, but he did not give up. Stephen told Alan to keep going. They headed through the neighborhood, then made a quick turn and then stopped. Stephen got out of the car and pointed his gun at the corner. He insisted that he always aimed high. He never wanted to kill anyone, but he did want this chase to stop. Once the cop came around the corner, Stephen fired again. and this time the cop slid his bike, ditched it, and rolled onto the ground into some high grass. A bevy of police cruisers soon rounded the corner as well. One of the officers began returning fire. Stephen got back into the car, and again, Alan floored it. But Stephen knew that they were cornered. The only way now was to ditch the car and to ditch the money, and they both foot bailed. Alan was caught right away, but Stephen, he darted across yards and in and out of houses, then into an apartment complex, where he ended up on the third floor, and he barreled into a random apartment. And there sat an elderly man and his wife. They were immigrants from Serbia. I'm not sure what Stephen said to them, but I'm pretty sure he didn't make them feel comfortable about leaving. He knew that the police were out in full force looking for him. All the while, he sat in that apartment talking to the old man about his days fighting back in Serbia. Eventually, Stephen dozed off, and as soon as they knew that he was asleep, made evident by his snoring, the elderly couple grabbed their coats and left the apartment and got in touch with police. The SWAT team arrived, and when they entered the apartment, Stephen was still sound asleep. The gunfire that the officer returned at Stephen Reed had been the first time the Victoria police had fired a weapon in more than 2 decades. Stephen Reed was tried, convicted, and sentenced to 18 years in prison. And Stephen hit an all-time low now that he was back locked up. But there was one thing that was different this time around. Because he was now considered a violent offender, he had to attend mandated counseling. And this would force Stephen to begin to confront the issues that had been plaguing him most of his life. What people on the outside looking in saw when they heard or read about Stephen was a very one-dimensional depiction. He was a young guy, addicted to drugs, he ran away from home, and he turned to crime to support his habit. He meets 2 guys, also criminals, and they form this band of thieves. And these are the types of gentlemen who pull off the perfect bank robberies without hurting a hair on anyone. But it wasn't until both of Stephen's parents passed away that he was willing to openly share what occurred when he was young. He would go on to publish his stories in the form of a collection of essays entitled A Crowbar in the Buddhist Garden. In it, he talked about befriending a doctor from his hometown named Paul. Paul used to give the then 11-year-old Stephen rides in his fancy cars and invite him over to his big house with all kinds of delicious foods and wines, things that Stephen had never seen before. He started allowing Stephen to drink alcohol, and before long, the doctor was giving him morphine pills and soon morphine injections. And as things progressed, the doctor began sexually abusing Stephen. But in the midst of this, Stephen became addicted to the drugs, and he needed Paul at the time to feed his addiction. Though from what he wrote, it seems like Stephen blamed himself for believing that the good things in life that he wanted were contained in every single syringe he emptied into his arms. Thousands of them, starting with Paul. Yes, but he kept chasing the high long after Paul was out of the picture. Paul no longer had any interest in Stephen once he hit puberty. By that time, Stephen was completely addicted, and now his only source of the drugs had turned on him. And everything that followed, the running away, the stealing to support his habits, all the robberies, and every crime that he would ever go on to commit, all of it had its origins from the day Paul no longer wanted him. Stephen continued to blame himself for years and years to come. But even through the counseling, he would never relegate himself to being the victim in his story. Because Paul can't be the one to blame for all of Stephen's trespasses in life, so Stephen says. He thinks his personality would have led him down the path of addiction anyway, regardless of Paul. In 2014, Stephen earned day parole for the final part of his sentencing. He could come and go, but he had a strict curfew at the halfway house of 10 p.m. During the day, he went to the cottage, the treehouse that he once shared with Susan. Her daughter, his stepdaughter, Charlotte Musgraves, she resided there with her kids, twin girls, who Stephen helped to take care of. On holidays, he was granted longer passes to go visit his wife, Susan, but most of his time was spent in Victoria. He passed by that corner every single day, that corner where he stood and opened fire on that motorcycle officer. His name was Bill Trudeau. He was working traffic duty when he got called about the robbery in progress. Stephen would forever continue to insist that he would never, ever intentionally shoot a cop or anyone. No matter what anyone thinks, he would have never shot that officer. The thing about that particular robbery that made it different from all the rest is that Stephen planned on failure. That's why he brought all those guns with him. He never planned for failure in the past because failure was not a thing when it came to the Stopwatch Gang. When he did that, when he went against everything he'd ever believed in and shot at that officer, he ruined both the lives of Stephen Reed, the rehabilitated family man and the legendary bank robber. Both of those sides of Stephen died that day. And after that, he was left with nothing. As for Lionel, he was never heard from after his 1994 release. He never spoke to anyone, the media, Stephen, or otherwise. Everyone who knew him lost track of him. As for Patty, he did write a book, and sometimes his accounts didn't exactly line up with Stephen's accounts. But at this point, much of their story was myth and legend anyway. Did it really matter? Well, it kind of mattered, at least to Stephen it did. He used to feed into the notion that they were a harmless band of criminals. They were considered to be folk heroes, gentlemen who robbed with unloaded guns, but it wasn't true, says Stephen. Their guns were loaded, and if they had to, they would have used them, but they never had to. However, part of this narrative kind of helped Stephen cope with all that he was doing. Witnesses would say in their statements that they didn't feel fear or threatened, and that helped him in a small way, though he didn't quite understand it. How could they feel safe when they were forced to the ground at gunpoint? He felt as though their story was kind of romanticized, and it really shouldn't have been. There was nothing good or romantic about what they were doing. They weren't Robin Hoods. They were taking the money and indulging in their addictions. And no, bank robbery isn't a victimless crime. No, they didn't plan these heists so nobody would get hurt. The truth is much more simple and much more blunt. They planned them well so they could maximize their takes, so they didn't have to work regular jobs. Stephen began to hate that myth. As for Patty, well, he and Stephen kept in touch over the years. Even when Patty was still a fugitive, when Stephen got out and Patty was still in, they continued to correspond. Patty was really proud and inspired by Stephen having turned his life around, and he thought about doing the same thing. Stephen said he would help him. Patty would go on to write a book of his own. He sent some passages from it to Stephen, and Stephen said he would publish it in a journal, but it needed a few changes. Patty didn't agree, so it never got published. Patty's book eventually was published, but Stephen never read it. He didn't think his book was completely honest, and he didn't like that. In 2006, Patty found a lump near his rib cage. He talked to the prison medic about it, but they told him to ignore it. But his lump grew, and eventually Patty was diagnosed with cancer. He was transferred to the Federal Correctional Institution in Butner, North Carolina, where terminally ill patients are housed. Stephen received one final letter from Patty around Christmas time of 2006. It wasn't that long, but it was hard to read. And the final line said, "We've had a life, haven't we?" Patty Mitchell succumbed to cancer on January 14, 2007. He was 64 years old. Patty's death had a deep and profound impact on Stephen. He missed his letters about his days spent at Leavenworth. By the time Patty was sent to prison for the last time, he had already been a granddad to two boys. Patty had tried repeatedly to beg the U.S. government for a transfer back to Canada so his grandchildren could visit him, but he was turned down a total of 5 times. Stephen penned an essay about his old friend, The Art of Dying in Prison. He wrote, "Pat and I shared a life so intertwined that his death seemed to pen a way for me to reconcile with the inevitability of my own dying. It became possible for me to hold my gaze on the end of life." And that, my dreamers, is the tale of the Stopwatch Gang. Some of the information in this episode came from a comprehensive article about this case in the Atavist magazine in 2014, written by Josh Dean. Thank you so much for listening, and until next time, sweet dreams.